So my name is Khaled. I'm from the University of Cambridge. In this talk, I will discuss a pilot study that we've done for Digitaly, which is an offline payment system dedicated for financial inclusion in developing countries. So Jasmine gave a background about mobile payments, so that's going to save me some time. Great work. Usually I have to explain how this works. So the mobile payment systems we're talking about are not Apple Pay, Google Pay, or whatever pay you have on your smartphone. Those are not what we're concerned with. What we're concerned with are mobile payments that are issued by your service operator, the mobile network operator. So the SIM in your phone acts as your identity keeper. Your identity is the phone number. So as you can see here, a few examples, two examples actually. Top left is Bcash in Bangladesh, and the rest of them are M-Pesa in Kenya. So if you wanted to receive money, you access the applet or the application on the SIM itself. You can see that the menu will allow you to buy airtime, send money, and so on. If you wanted to increase your balance, besides receiving payments, you will take the cash to an agent. As you can see on the top right, you will give the cash to an agent. They will document this transaction, as you can see at the bottom right, and then they will let you sign for that transaction. So these payment systems work by sending an SMS or encrypted SMS to the operator so they can change the balance on your account. And the receiver will get a confirmation that the transaction was successful. So mobile payments have been transformative. They brought banking to people who didn't have bank accounts before because of regulation that really suppresses the ability for this target population to open bank accounts. So anti-money laundering regulation, know your customer regulation. So their identity really becomes their phone number. That's all they have. And the service operators give them the ability to transact. So the killer application here were remittances. So some people working in the capital, for example, in Nairobi, will send payments to their relatives or friends in remote villages. This is way more secure than the systems that they had before, where you would send funds with your friends or family members or bus companies, as they call them, to deliver the payments to your relatives. And it can get lost or stolen. And governments want to use these mechanisms to deliver benefits directly to their users by mapping the identity of the users directly with the phone numbers. So we started thinking about the remaining challenges. What else can we do to enhance the ability to reach people who are previously not reachable with these payment systems? And what we want to do is think about resilience of payment systems. Can we extend it to areas where there is no network? Can we make the service available when it's intermittent, such that it works when the system is unavailable, but when the system is available, then the system is restored and works seamlessly? What we want to do as well is cut transaction fees, because for the target population who are living on $1 or $2 a day, the transaction fee is a significant chunk of their income. So what really started this project, or got it really kick-started it, was the Gates Foundation request for proposals to increase merchant uptake of mobile payment systems. So we started talking to operators and users in remote areas and people who were consulted on these payment systems to understand if what we were thinking about was actually correct. And they said there are network issues. There are areas where you barely get any receptions. And the costs are significant, especially for the target population, as I explained before. So we said, okay, fine, how do you do payment systems offline if between phones if there is no network? Basically, the mobile payment system that Jasmine was talking about, that I talked about earlier, work by sending SMS. But if you don't have SMS, if you don't have a GSM network, how do you do that? Now, if you have a smartphone, you can build an app and have them communicate in ad hoc, Bluetooth or what have you. But how do you do that with feature phones? Now, why do we want to focus on feature phones? Because we want to make an impact, an immediate impact now, not when smartphones get popular in a few years. So to validate some of the assumptions, we got on a plane for an hour, two-hour drive. We get to the west of Kenya, right on the border, Lake Victoria, between Kenya and Uganda. And over there, we met with the Busia County offices, the officials who are responsible for tax revenue. And just to give you an understanding of what they're really requiring, I thought that was very valuable, our visit to the offices. They said, one of them stood, the gentleman is in the back, so you can't really see him in this picture. He said, look, it's really good that you came here, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit because it was in Swahili, so it was translated to me. He said, it's great that you are here, but don't give us any solutions for smartphones because we don't have them. We don't really know how to use them. So I said, can you show us, can everyone in the crowd show me the phone in your pockets right now? And 25 of them about show me a feature phone. And one of them was a BlackBerry, and the keyboard was broken and had tape over it. So that's what they want. They want feature phone solutions, although these are considered, the people I spoke to are considered the most well-off in the county itself, and they still wanted feature phones. So we designed Digitalia as a prototype system to investigate the offline payment systems and the uptake for these solutions and what factors we might have to address to deploy a system that is offline, basically, doesn't have to work online. So Digitalia, and I'll explain this more in a few minutes, works by copying short digits between phones back and forth. Now, it can be implemented in SIM Toolkit. The SIM Toolkit means it's an applet in the SIM itself, or as a smartphone app. For the reasons that I just mentioned, we're not focusing on smartphone apps. We want to focus on feature phones, and we want to provide a solution for feature phones that works on smartphones, because the vice versa is not always correct. But the SIM toolkit, the SIM itself, is already taken by the mobile network operator. There is a slot for one SIM in the feature phone, and that's already taken by the dominant operator over there, and they don't give us access to program it, although they could in a sandbox environment, and we don't even have to touch their offering. But they wouldn't give us access to their SIM to program. So the enabling technology is really an overlay SIM. If we didn't have this, we probably would have abandoned this project in the beginning. So this works as a SIM. It's exactly a SIM. It's just thinner that you can peel the sticker off. You can stick it on top of another SIM. You stick this SIM, the combined structure, together in the single SIM slot. And what you have is effectively two SIMs and a single feature phone. This was not possible before. Now, we came across this because we talked to consultants and said if they wanted to do crypto, this is the only way you can do it on a feature phone. And this, if to give you an idea, this was used in China in the early 2000s for roaming purposes, and it was used by a bank in Kenya to bypass the mobile network operator's restriction on the device. So we used the same concept, and we programmed this in JavaCard in the hopes that this bank will also use the same technology, and all they have to do is really insert it in their SIM, and that's it. So they copy-paste our code, and they're fine. So to highlight some of the designs that goals that we wanted to work with, we want to work with the existing environment, not in 5-10 years when smartphones are popular, as I mentioned before. But we also did not want to require or introduce any unfamiliar hardware. We can do a lot with smartphone apps. We can do a lot with Raspberry Pis. I understand that. But that's not something anyone is able to subsidize for the target population. All they have are the phones. So we want to work exactly with that. And they put the overlay inside their phone, and they don't have to worry about it. They don't have to familiarize themselves with any new technology. So now we come to the Digitalia payment itself. So I'm not going to explain all the details about the crypto. This was published in a previous publication, actually, in SPW. But the way it works, if we have Alice and Bob, Alice wants to pay Bob 450 shillings. They agree on the amount. They already have their identity stored in the phone book. What they do then is Bob selects receive money from his phone. He enters this code, or he selects 450, or he enters 450 in his phone. This will generate a challenge, basically, an 8-digit challenge, which is the message authentication code. Now, how is the message authentication code created? The SIM itself, the Digitalia SIM, or the overlay, is capable of generating this code based on the symmetric keys that we have loaded into the SIM. So he gives Alice this code. Alice puts it in her phone. Her phone can agree or decide if this code is valid based on the same symmetric key that is uploaded in Digitalia applet, and they can agree or reject this code. And this code is basically the MAC, the message authentication code of all the transaction inputs. So the amount, the identities, the previous history, and a lot of things that are embedded in this message authentication code. If they agree, then Alice will create the response for this transaction itself. That means the transaction they agree on the transaction parameters, and what they want to do now is finalize or authorize this payment. It will say, give Bob code 2, and the code 2 will be also 8 digits. Bob will enter that 8-digit in his phone, and then they get a log that the transaction was successful. If the code was not correct, then they will get an error that says, okay, you have to try again, and they get a counter for that. So we built this thing, we put it on Java card in the overlay sim, and we collaborated with Sagamore University in Nairobi, Kenya. We had 90 participants, and the study took 5 days. We loaded a certain amount for the students to spend with the outlets, the vendors, and the university, and we had 3 of them with varying traffic of customers. So to give you an idea what that looks like, we have the bookshop on the left. The staff member is hanging up a sign that says Digital is accepted here. On the right, there's a cafeteria where there's a screen between the customer and the cashier, so they can't really hear each other. So they decided to show the code through the screen. The coffee shop also had almost similar experience to the bookshop, but the vendor was not dedicated to receiving the payments. She would start the payment, she would leave the phone on the counter, at least that's what we observed, and then she would go prepare the food and then come back. So she had an almost a use that we didn't really design for, that is someone not dedicated for the payment. So what we collected in the sim were the error rates, the number of transactions, and we were primarily concerned with the duration times. We wanted to compare it to the existing experience of payment systems in Kenya and elsewhere. And to give you briefly about the idea, there's more in the paper itself, so I have to convince you to read the paper, but what we're looking for is the percentage of the errors with regards to the transaction total. And we see that they are relatively lower, but what we're looking for are any fatal flaws, that is, errors that will stop transaction from completing, and we didn't find anything that will stop transaction from being completed. So the average time ranged from 20 seconds to about a minute. Now, regular mobile payments can take up to a minute because you have to wait for the confirmation of the payment to be sent to the recipient. So we think that 24 seconds up to a minute is comparable to existing systems. Merchants who had similar experience, they had lower code errors, although they did more transactions, and you can see the third row, that's the average time is much higher because that's the merchant who was not dedicated for receiving a payment. She will start the payment, and then she will go serve the customer and then come back. With the system usability scale, I'm not going through all of them, but what we're looking for and what results show, are high scores indicate usability, ease of use, and learnability after a period of time. And we were hoping to get some indication that the population might be promoters for the technology itself, because technical support is not going to always be available. Now, for the sake of time, my final remarks are going to be that we were looking to investigate the usability problems about Digitalia itself, but what we included in the paper are some of the points that I wish I knew before we started this project, including what really the target population or people are interact with the target population are looking for: perceived security, deterministic protocol, it works when there is no offline, or the system is offline, but it can be restored when the system is available. So the research direction we really want to think about is rethink or reintroduce resilience and through offline capabilities. They're ripped out of most systems, even payment systems now, they were capable of working offline. They can't now because everything is processed online. And we want to focus on the bottom billion, the effects of unreliable network on their experience, their usability. And if we can do that, maybe we can give the users what they need in the form that they need it. Efficient, resilient, hopefully secure and usable. Maybe this is, if we focus on this population and what they really require, maybe it's better than putting drones in the sky and hot air balloons. But that's my take on it. Thank you.
Please, if you want to ask questions, please come up to the microphones.
Hi, my name is Arab Buksani. I work at MIT Lincoln Lab. One of my questions is, why did the merchant's score seem a little bit lower than the typical user's score? And can you talk a little bit about like what factored into that? I'm imagining if the merchants don't want to use it, and I'm sure they would rather have this than something else, but if they don't want to use it, then it makes it easier for the users that do want to use it, the buyers, to use it.
So why the system usability scores were different between both. It's probably because of the merchants themselves did not want to, for example, adopt any technology that would increase the work that they have to do. It could be that they don't really want to bother with this payment system, although some of them said they liked it. Now, the third row, you will see that the average time was much higher because she didn't like the system because it was too much of a hassle. She didn't want to start the payment and then come back to it. When she learned that if you start the payment and nobody can do anything with your system, she liked it, but she still gave us negative feedback and the score was fine. But that's what I think. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Hello, Malik, engineer from Facebook. I have a question. How different is the populations that you're targeting here from, let's say, the population targeted by projects with drones and balloons and subsidized networks?
Mm-hmm. Well, the target population that you have in the drones, they are sparsely populated. So if you beam into technology that they can't really use on their feature phones, I don't really see the point of it. But the target population we worked in with, they would be the people who came from the villages that we're concerned to actually help, the target population themselves. And some of them they come from diverse backgrounds, and some of them came from the villages that we actually want to work in. So how is it different from the target population? I have no idea what the target population is for the Facebook drones or what have you. I mean, they want to increase the uptake, but what are the numbers and return on investment that they have?
Okay, thanks.
I may have dozed off briefly and missed this. Sweet.
Sorry?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, did you do any testing of the physical resilience of that overlay chip? Mm-hmm. Does it ever come loose? Does that cause any problems?
Excellent question. It's not resilient in the sense you can't really use it as a SIM swap. For example, the SIMs in developing countries would be easily used on the same device, so you remove the SIM itself. But you cannot use the overlay. It's not resilient at all. For example, if you keep moving it, swapping into other devices, the adhesive itself would wear out, and you can't really use it. So it's something that you would stick on the device maybe once, twice, and then that's it. You can't really use it again.
Okay.